Okay, everyone, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lens. This is your host, Big John, alongside my friend and partner, Mr. Mike Termott on the lens. And Mike, today's episode, I think, let's call it the all-nerd episode, because we're going to talk economic effects, we're going to talk tariffs, inflation. I might even have some numbers to throw out. I even brought my reading glasses, so you know we're going to get nerded up. But before we do, how are you feeling today, my friend?
I'm doing great. I do look forward to whatever data you want to trot out. And I would like to suggest that we need to move fairly quickly through today's episode because things might change before we get off of our recording here so quickly as the White House changing course with regard to particular tariffs.
Yeah, and for the good old days, Mike, when we used to have to wait, what, 2, 3, 4 months before we got inflation data, CPA data, tariff results, now we get them in 10 days. And so everything's changing, Mike, everything's changing.
Everything okay. Is changing, although sometimes it takes 3 months to find someone that actually interprets it correctly.
That's a good point. Okay, so let's start. Tariffs. Basically, Trump's tariffs went into effect March 4th. And
some of them,
he's walked back some of them. He's doubled down on others. So it's a huge rigmarole. First of all, Mike, quickly sort of recap for the folks. Yep. What are these tariffs? Who are they targeting and why?
We're targeting everyone in the world, and least of all the people that you might think that we'd go after the hardest, right?
Right.
We're not pressing down on Russia and China too much at the moment because we want to be able to press down on them harder later. And the White House is particularly laying off of Russia because we're trying to cut a deal with regard to Ukraine.
Right.
And while we understand this, it does introduce a bit of a cringe factor because at the moment it looks like the big tariff fight is with Canada. We have imposed tariffs and then backed off of them with regard to Mexico, the White House having the opportunity to claim that Mexico did what it was that the president wanted them to do, which was help control the border. And so that gave a graceful exit from some of the most onerous tariffs on Mexico. But we have in place tough tariffs around the world on the import of aluminum and other metals. The White House threatened to double down, well, actually quintuple down on tariffs on dairy products coming in from Canada.
Right.
And these are two of the most interesting, I think, that your audience has, you know, been subject to hearing about the last few days, and it has raised the specter of really an all-out tariff war, a trade fight with the Canadians, which is unfortunate on a couple of different levels. One is we have huge trade with Canada and with China, of course, right. But with the Canadians, a lot of this trade, let me draw a distinction between types of trade between Canada and China. The stuff that we import from China is stuff that we import notwithstanding the enormous cost of getting it here, right? And so it's a lot of stuff that we're fairly price insensitive to. And so when the president does eventually impose the 25% across the board tariff on China, as looks like it very well could be the case, that's going to be costs that are passed on probably to Americans, because we will be acquiring this stuff anyway, notwithstanding the price hikes. Right. Whereas some of the stuff that we import from Canada, right, is due to fairly subtle price advantages, right? You could imagine a few percentage difference in the price of you know, an egg or dairy product or something, or as we all learned the other day, electricity, specifically from Ontario, fairly subtle differences drive trade between the United States and Canada. So you put a tariff on some of that stuff, you run the risk of shutting it down, which doesn't sound like that big a deal if you're only losing a few pennies on the dollar and buying it American. The problem is that the adjustments that result from that can be fairly significant in terms of jobs. If it only takes a few percentage point changes in pricing,
right,
to change from whom you're buying this stuff, then the ultimate effect could be quite significant in terms of readjusting employment.
Right, and I think that's where a lot of people, because you see a lot of chatter, like some of these influencers online saying like, okay, so what, I'm not getting Canadian beer? Damn it, I'll just buy Bud or I'll buy Coors, right? And they seem to miss the subtlety until, you know, if you're in the north on the northeastern seaboard, say New York, Massachusetts, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, you guys are playing this game? Great. We're not going to send electricity across the border. And now what happens, right? Because now it's not just I'll buy another can of beer at a higher price. Now, I you know, my utility costs go up. The cost of everything that runs off electricity goes up.
It does.
Yeah,
and if you live in a part of the United States in which you have a capacity challenge because you've been expecting, anticipating, planning right. on receiving a lot of electricity from Canada, right?
Right.
And all of a sudden, you know, you switch to a different part of the grid here in the United States, and that leads to capacity challenges. Well, we know that's where brownouts come from, the occasional network failures. All of a sudden, you've got some real issues. And as I just mentioned, the dislocation in terms of jobs. And for every job change there is on the Canadian side, there's going to be one on the American side. Remember that when we buy less stuff from Canada, that means less currency that we're sending to them, and therefore less currency coming back to us. So they're buying less stuff from us too. This is not a one-way
right.
shutdown.
Yeah, I mean, look, excuse me, the political hyperbole aside, because I've seen some nonsense stuff, Mike, which I'm sure you would agree. I've seen the White House try to spin it that tariffs are actually tax rebates to the American citizen that, you know, and Trump is saying, hey, you don't have to worry about costs because, hey, we're going to bring in billions in tariff revenue. You know, there's all this weird sort of politicking.
Right.
On top of which, you're seeing things like I was going to make the point here, and actually it slipped out of my head while I was talking to you. But there is the politicization of the tariffs where you're saying like, okay, stuff that we would only do to our worst enemies during wartime, we're now trying to accomplish during peacetime by saying we're targeting, 25% on Canadian-Mexican goods, as you mentioned, 10% on Canadian energy, 20% on Chinese goods. The retaliation, Canada has imposed 25% tariffs on nearly $21 billion worth of U.S. exports. Mexico planned similar retaliations. Now, the thing I will point out is, Mr. Trump, which I think even any his most ardent supporters will admit, is a populist. Like he's a man of the people, correct? Well,
correct,
what was it
100%.
Like? Within 48 hours of his tariff announcements, the U.S. auto industry pushed back. The U.S. steel industry pushed back. All of a sudden, he says, well, you know, tariffs, except for these guys.
Right.
Right. Which
and that's how you end up in these silly situations in the first place.
Right.
One of the things, I'm glad you brought that up. One of the things that the White House has pointed to, and we need to get to the communications challenge that I believe the White House is not handling very well.
Right.
But set that aside for just a moment. But one of the things that they're pointing to as an excuse or a reason to fight back against the Canadians is that the Canadians have had significant trade barriers against American dairy and against certain other American farm products, which we get. about which we've been pissed for a generation. It seems to me when I was in grad school, we were upset about this kind of thing. It's been much more than a dog's age that this has been a problem, right? And we say, well, they do it to us, so we're going to, you know, do it to them. And there is a tit-for-tat quality to this that doesn't ring very well politically. It ends up sounding a little bit like, I know you are, but what am I? Right. And I wish that this was articulated backwards relative to how it has been. In other words, if the White House had come out of the box in November, or at least in January, but even in November, right after the election, or during the campaign, and said, you know, we're pissed off about Canadian tariffs on farm products, and we stand up for American farmers, especially the dairy farmers, and we're going to get rid of those tariffs. Here's how we're going to do it. We're going to impose tariffs on Canadian goods to punish them until they play ball and we get a free trade agreement, and this time it's going to be a real free trade agreement. If you said that months ago, a lot of, you know, foolish economists like us and libertarians would be more supportive, and a lot of business folks would be more supportive because they would feel like you're going in the direction in which we want you to go.
Right.
Whereas right now, it just sounds like you're trying to cut a deal and carve outs for your buddies or for the squeaky wheel, and it has a very different feel to it.
Right, and here's the thing, right? I mean, I'm always of the belief, Mike, I think you are as well, that even unilateral free trade is preferable to bilateral tariffs, right? Like,
absolutely, it is, and very few people appreciate that fact. Keep going. Talk about that.
So agreed that having tariffs against us is not preferable. I get that. And I understand the very human reaction to say, well, like you said, tit for tat, we're on the playground. You punch me, I'll punch you. You pull her pigtails, I'll pull your pigtails. I get it. But can an administration that supposedly is based on sound financial principles, allegedly, can we understand that unilateral free trade, where we say we're trading with the whole world, we're allowing the free movement of goods and services, still benefits way more Americans than it hurts? And I think tying back into Trump's, like, okay, we're going to exclude this particular vertical industry from tariffs, we're going to exclude this industry from tariffs, just further reinforces the political cronyism that's attached to this, to these tariffs. It's like, if you could pay to get into Trump's ear, you don't get hit with the tariffs.
Well,
you can continue.
That is the way it comes off. In fairness, I don't know whether that's the case or whether the White House really just doesn't understand this very well. And you put your finger on an issue that rarely comes up. I don't think most people understand that if the world is imposing an array of tariffs and other trade barriers on your nation, you are still, nonetheless, better off from an efficiency and cost savings and promotion of investment basis and stabilization of currencies, every which way, you're better off saying, well, that sucks, but I'm not going to impose extra tariffs. I'm not going to impose extra trade barriers. I still believe in free trade. I'm still going to allow the American citizenry to do whatever they want to do. You're still better off. The only reason, there are two reasons to impose tariffs that make sense from an economic point of view.
I know of one, but hit me with two, Mike.
One is negotiation.
Okay.
One is just, I'm going to punish you, for doing something in the trade realm by doing something in the trade realm, and we'll both relieve our barriers or our tariffs together when we come to an agreement. In that sense, it doesn't need to be a tariff, right? if someone tariffs you or puts up a trade barrier, you can punish them with something else if you want. You know, you can just say nasty things about them in the press, or you can drop a bomb on them, right? There's all kinds of weird stuff that you can do.
Right.
We're all grateful that, you know, that when people get into trade wars, they keep it typically, not always, but they keep it to trade fighting instead of aggressive, you know, militaristic fighting. And the second place in which it makes economic sense is not from the standpoint of promoting efficiency, but rather promoting net revenue to your particular government and your particular nation. In other words, if you are a big enough player in many of these markets, the United States is, that you can force someone who is selling to you to eat the cost and not pass it on to your buyers.
It's the typical economies of scale that you're referring to.
Economies of scale and being a bit of a monopsonist. Being such a big player in the buy market that you can't go anywhere else, right? You've got to sell to us. I'm imposing a tariff. I'm deciding the price. You're just going to have to eat it. It's going to have to come out of your profits, or it's going to have to come out of your government. Yes. It's, you know, you go find it, but you're going to eat the cost of this tariff. And so it doesn't punish my economy too bad in terms of efficiency. My citizens don't have to eat most of the cost. It turns into revenue to my government. That reduces, you know, the debt and the future tax burden on my people. It's all good. From a global point of view, that's still a loss.
Right. Well,
but if you can, you know, if you're just, you know, one economy, if you're just the White House, if you're just the U.S. federal government, and you can push that cost onto someone else, that's a circumstance in which it might make nationalistic sense. Not from a global perspective, but it could make national sense.
I apologize, Mike. I wasn't laughing at the point you were making. In my head, I was silently cursing you for forcing me to remember all the ancient Greek that my mother taught me to figure out what monopsonist meant. And I got it. I got the Greek word. I finally extracted the Greek root out of it.
Single buyer. Single seller and could impose price increases on the market. Right. A monopsonist is someone who is such the big player in the buy market that can impose prices on the sellers and force these sellers to eat the extra cost.
Yeah, psonisti in Greek is ancient Greek for a buyer. So that's what had me chuckling, Mike. I apologize. I can't help myself.
All good.
Those who know my last name know why I would be going through that exercise. Okay, let's go on to the next thing, Mike. And thank you for that. That was still great. Sort of like understanding how tariffs really are not that beneficial. They may have political purposes, but they're really not economically beneficial. Let's move on to inflation, because the White House yesterday claimed, hey, our policies are so great, we've already seen a decrease in the CPI. We are lowering inflation. And then Elon Musk came out and said, see, this is what happens when, in fact, you cut federal spending. Good things happen. Oh, and I may add, before I move off of it very quickly, as a result of Trump's tariffs, while he was announcing them, we saw a $4 trillion loss evaporated in the stock market, which is ironic for a president whose part of his many campaign slogans was, how's your 401k doing? How's your 401k doing under Biden?
And Chuck was a business guy from New York, right?
Right. And through his words alone, he knocked off $4 trillion the first day he announced these ridiculous tariffs. And then the markets continue to slide as he claims he's willing to throw the nation into a recession to, quote, fix whatever he thinks needs fixing. So just to put that cherry on the sundae there, let's move on to inflation. Now, the White House was touting, and as far as the data I looked up, I put on my nerd glasses, Mike, there was a 0.2% decrease in the CPI month over month. And again, the claim was this was due to the cut in federal spending. So I decided to look into it a little bit. Yep. First of all, spending year over year for January, since Trump took office, let's be fair, in January and February, if you look at each month individually, net spending actually increased year over year.
Sure, absolutely.
So you went up $28 billion year over year in January. The increase was $21 billion. Year yep. over year in yep. February, you had now.
And for the most part, that's just normal economic expansion of the government. It's not sure. really policy. It's not like the White House made these decisions. 100% spending.
100% agreed with you. And 100% agree that I would not have attributed any of this to Trump, to be honest. Like, if you're,
no,
if you're
no,
being
no,
fair.
No, not, not, of course not.
Right.
It's sort of when I was growing up a Cubs fan, which that's a whole nother podcast.
Right.
But, you know, there were announcers who on WGN would tell you that because the Cubs were winning, right, the weather was better, the grass was greener.
Right.
The beer tasted better, that hot dogs were longer, and the buns were fresher. Because the Cubs were winning. Now, I don't begrudge a good, you know, marketing campaign. You know, I mean, I remembered it all these years because it was just that effective.
Right.
And that's a little bit of what the White House is doing now, right? Because Doge is finding things that, you know, good for them for finding stuff that probably is a little bit silly and needs to be cut out, and they're finding some savings. You know, inflation is less and grass is greener and hot dog buns are fresher. Good for them, right? Good for them. But the truth of the matter is that none of that has anything to do with anything that's important or interesting.
Right. Right, and that's my point, right? So while I'm perfectly willing to say, hey, Doge is great at saying, here's waste, there's waste, none of it has, to any significant degree, actually been cut yet.
Right.
And while the inflation rate...
Nor is it an order of magnitude that will affect the CPI in a measurable fashion.
Agreed. But to your point, let's set it up as marketing versus reality, right? And the truth of the matter is, if you're going to claim a significant victory for that 0.2% reduction in CPI, the truth of the matter is the person who should get credit for that is Biden, right? Because in February,
of that had already been set up. That's
Had been set up.
Now, and there's a little, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Although I do think that'll be lost on the public. So I'm not sure that's going to carry the day.
That's what we're here for, though, Mike.
One more element of this that I would be careful about, which I would caution the White House communications function. That is sort of a live by the sword, die by the sword admonition. If you're going to celebrate such tiny changes in the CPI.
Yeah, yes, exactly. What happens when it goes in the other direction?
It does go the other direction. Yeah. It is out of your control, and so I don't know that you want to be dying on that hill. You know, CPI is largely controlled by the creation of money supply, which is much more in the Fed's hands than in yours, right? And so that's not a hill on which to die because it's under your control.
Right.
And you're going to have to sweat this out now every month like a CEO watching his profit line. That is not a world in which you want to live from a communication standpoint.
Agreed.
The other thing is,
go ahead. Yep.
If you already know that you're going to go through the imposition of tariffs and therefore an adjustment process, which could impose, by your own admission, some extra cost in the short run.
Right.
Why would you want to draw attention to every 4 or 5 weeks we're going to have a new CPI number?
Yeah.
You know,
I agree with you.
That is not something that you want to focus on.
I agree with you. And listen, I think this goes to a lot of what the Trump administration, to your point, does around communication, how they market, what they decide to tout. like, not to get too far off topic, but we saw how this goes, right? With the supposed release of the Epstein files, they gathered up, half a dozen to a dozen of their favorite right-wing MAGA influencers, right? The new media, got no problem with that, who just conveniently happened to waltz into a photo op by accident, and then all releasing the same message, the exact same verbiage, very reminiscent of CNN and MSNBC, where they all had the same leftist talking points, right?
Yep.
So if you're going to play that game, it's a very dangerous game to play because, to your point, you're going to go, and especially if you're taking on these faulty economic premises like trade wars and tariffs and cronyism, right? Like, all this stuff will cause these wild gyrations. Mike, we don't need to talk about coefficients of variance, but you know what I mean. It's going to swing. And people aren't smart enough to understand, statistical control processes and
data. Well, and they don't want to be, you know. Right, and none of us wants to have to focus on whether this piece of data means more in February than it does in July. All we're going to know is the White House really thinks this is an important thing for us to pay attention to. And if it goes the wrong direction on them, dear. Yes, you and I have talked about this before. It would just be my advice to the White House to have a more longer-term strategic method of viewing the communications function to realize, you know, you're going to have some challenges. If you believe, and I think the jury is out, but if you believe that the president is good at cutting deals and not interested in insulating himself from temporary flack on the way, right? I mean, you know, good for him if he's willing to put up with the blowback from having a bad argument in, you know, the Oval Office with Zelensky, or he's okay with putting up with the blowback from appearing maybe a little bit too pro-Russia, not sufficiently anti-Russia. You know, if he's willing to put up with these short-term challenges in order to get what he wants in the long run, good for him. But that means he needs to gather together the communications function at some point and say, look, people, we need to talk about these issues in the long run. I don't need you riding my ass about what the CPI is in January. When I'm trying to get something done that's only going to pay benefits in year four of this administration, right?
You know, I'm glad you said that, Mike, because as much as I am anti-Trump, I would have cut him slack on that. Personally, as much as I don't like him at all, if he had said, look, we're going to go through some pain, check with me in a year, and we'll take a pulse at a year because that's how long these things take, I would have been, okay, fair enough. Let's see a year from now. Because it brings to mind what, you know, the Milton Friedman, Ronald Reagan dynamic when we were coming out of stagflation from 78, 79 into 80. You know, Reagan listened to Friedman and he said, look, we're going to go through a year, year and a half of horrible, horrible pain economically.
Yep.
But the benefits will be there and we're going to come out of this on the right side, you know. And And people were prepared. They knew interest rates were going to go up. They knew mortgage rates were going to hit 13-14%. Yes, people, that's how high it hit.
Even if you didn't, even if you were skeptical about the benefits in the long run, at least it took the wind out of the sails of people who would hammer you on monthly data.
Exactly, exactly. So I think to your point, let's get, you know, if Trump wants the benefit of the doubt, I think he has to ignore the temptation of saying, hey, we're better, 0.2%, and then just ignore the fact that the stock market, which he, by the way, was a big, you know, the economy is the stock market. We said it was wrong, but that's what he touted. $4 trillion, according to his words, gone. 401ks losing anywhere between 7 to 10% of their value in a week is crazy, and he should own that if he's going to take the victories as well.
I agree, and this goes to another element of his communication challenge and lack of communication strategy, or at least a lack of execution on a good communication strategy. I think that the loss in the stock market also reflects a potentially a miscommunication. And I don't want to minimize the extent to which a lot of corporations out there are fearful of the tariffs themselves.
Right.
But a big piece of this is just not knowing that the White House wants to eradicate these tariffs through negotiation.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are afraid that a lot of these tariffs are going to remain in place because what the White House wants to do, and this has been said from that podium, that, you know, there's just a new regime where we're trying to import wealth and investment into manufacturing sectors and to put people to work in different types of jobs. Well, that is not the message the market wants to hear. The market wants to hear that we're going to get to do whatever the hell we want to do because it's the most efficient way to run an economy. Leave well enough alone and we will show you growth rather than imposing adjustments, right? Thou shalt not impose adjustments if you want economic growth and efficiency and for the stock market to reflect that. Because remember that the stock market is a long reflects when it works well, and it doesn't always, but when it's working well, it is supposed to be a reflection of the long-term outlook for investment and performance on that investment.
Yes.
And that means a long-term, stable, favorable outlook on investments that we're making now. And if you tell me we're going through an adjustment, that necessarily means that the investment I made last week or last year may not be everything that I would have done if I had known the silly stuff we're going to go through.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, when I was on the street, you were on the street, you know the old saying, I can make money in an up market, I can make money in a down market. What I can't do is make money when I don't know what the hell is going on. And that uncertainty is the enemy of the stock markets, of the bond markets, of the commodities markets. Any market hates uncertainty. When that volatility index goes up, all bets are off, right? So that's one thing. And the second thing is the way you phrased it kind of brought to mind old Politburo, Central Committee planning. We're going to impose that certain sectors benefit at the expense of others, which really is what tariffs do at the end of the day.
Yes, they do.
They favor one industry over another, over several, as a matter of fact. So, yeah, the White House would be A, well served to communicate what they want to do to stabilize the markets, and two, just get off this horse of thinking you know how to best run the economy. Hayek
said
it, and you know, it's like.
And there's one more element I'd like to point out that that I think you introduced when you were
talking. My fault then.
Yes, this is totally your fault. We can wrap up now, but I need to make this point because you introduced the concept.
Yes. Go ahead.
That people are better off when they are able to predict what's going to happen next, right? And that's the case for markets and long-term investment. It is also the case for any type of relationship, right?
Right.
When you can trust someone, even if you know they're going to do stupid crap, if you know what stupid crap they're going to do, you can deal with that in a more effective and a more efficient way. You know, men out there who can hear my voice, you become a more attractive partner when people know what it is that you're going to do, right? I have often said it is a reflection of a man's character, his predictability, as opposed to, you know, charisma and being fun, that's great when you're 19. But if you want to, you know, build a family on someone, give me someone predictable, right?
Very and, Jordan Peterson of you, Mike.
No, that may be. I'll try to take that as a compliment.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, by the way, but okay, yeah.
And this needs to be said with regard to international relations and investment policy. If I know where you're going, I'm going to cut you more slack. I'm willing to work with you. I'm willing to make greater investment.
Yep.
And this is part of the problem that we're having with, for example, Canada, right? I'm not a big fan of sweeping stuff under the rug and covering it up, and you can tariff us for 25 years and we're going to put up with it. I'm not suggesting that. But nor do I think it's a good idea for whatever rhetoric it is that caused us to all of a sudden have hockey fights before the puck gets dropped, right? I'm sorry, you have done something wrong when the Star Spangled Banner is being booed in professional hockey games. Something has gone wrong, and for no good reason. Whereas if we had articulated, this is where we're going, this is what it is we're trying to achieve, this is what you can trust us right. to be trying to get done, you have a very different outlook. And where this comes from, and I don't mean to necessarily per se sound like a libertarian, but if I can be accorded a little bit of slack here, it's a matter of principle. When you articulate your principles, you signal where you're going in the long run. In other words, if you were to say, we're all about free markets and free trade, and we're all about letting you do what you want to do, and we don't believe the government ought to be controlling markets and bossing you around and guiding investment, right? You just say that as a matter of principle, right. And you say it hard and frequently. Then, when it, you know, all of a sudden you say, we're imposing a big fat tariff on Canadian eggs.
Right.
People would be like, okay, that doesn't fit. What's up with that? And right. you say, it's because where we're going in the long run. This is a negotiation thing. Our relationship with Canada is strong. It matters. We want it to be terrific, but we got to work our way through this issue. You get a very different feel and a different response from markets, including the stock market.
I agree. And also, I'll just end it on this, Mike. It also doesn't help when you have the other childlike rhetoric of referring to the prime minister as the governor of our 51st state. And it also doesn't help saying the people in Canada want to become our 51st state. Because to your point, if you're signaling principles, you've just signaled that you're a five-year-old when you talk like that, right? You signaled either aggression's coming. Hey, if you don't join up, we're going to send the B-52s or whatever we send nowadays. We're going to send the drones. We're going to, you know. So, you know, and I'm not suggesting we're ready to invade Canada, but if you're going to talk like that and you're the president of the United States, why wouldn't I take you at your word, right? Because either you're telling me you're a liar, or to be frank, you're delusional. So which one is it? And you're not leaving me any choice by your own rhetoric. So I just wanted to throw that into the trade talk.
No, I totally agree. We need the president to stay on message. We need the White House to be more strategic with regard to its communication.
Yeah, and again, coming from someone who doesn't particularly like Trump, I'm the first one to say he's shooting himself in the foot. For every one good thing I could agree with that he's done or purported to have done, he'll shoot himself twice in the foot just to make up for it.
I completely understand. I am optimistic that the stock market is going to recover, that the White House communication and strategy and negotiations will recover, and we will avoid a recession. But to your point, it's not obvious.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on that note of optimism, I'll just say this has been Liberty Lens for this week with Mike Termott and Big John. We'll catch you again next Thursday when a new episode drops. Make sure to catch us live on Free For All, live streaming Thursday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll have guests like Mr. Mike Termott to come on and talk about issues of the day. Until then, for Mike and Big John, peace, everyone.